All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, talking to you from New York City on this, the 29th day of June, 2021. And we do want to thank all of you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel, and also encourage you to send along whatever comments you have about the show to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. I also want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Our sponsors for today's show, Novo Resources, Sitka Gold Corp, El Oro Resources, Irving Resources, Hannon Metals, Lion One Metals, SK Mining Corp, NV Gold Corp, and Firefox Gold. I've titled today's show, Monetary Climate Change and Gold. Peter Stoferle and Dr. Quentin Henning return as my guests this week. The Fourth Turning, a book written in 1997, predicted that during the mid-2000s, major social, economic, and political changes would occur in the United States. The 2008 financial crisis was followed by the election of Barack Obama. In my view, those events have indeed marked the start of America's Fourth Turning. Fourth Turnings always bring major social and political change. And so we now see BLM and Antifa clamor for Marxist rule, and many, if not most, Democrats and the intelligence community seem to be in sympathy with those aspirations. Lenin said that the best way to destroy the capitalist system is through currency debasement, because by so doing, governments can confiscate wealth secretly and unobserved from an important part of its citizenry. Whether these forces destroy all that 1776 bequeathed to Americans, only our Creator knows for sure. But if currency debasement is the best way to destroy capitalism, America is well on its way toward that end. From the 2021 edition of In Gold We Trust, co-author Ronald Soferle will explain in the second half of today's show why he believes the U.S. has reached a tipping point where inflationary forces have begun to dominate. But the one thing that remains unchanged and secure as long as this world endures is the purchasing power of gold. Thus, the need to own it and shares in the companies that produce it, especially in times like these. That premise is, of course, tested from time to time in the short run, as it is now with gold's recent decline of more than $200 an ounce. Michael Oliver is not with us today, so I thought I would take a look at some of his most recent comments on gold, just to see and reassure myself that there's nothing too much to worry about. On his June 22nd trend sheet report, Michael stated unequivocally, and I quote, "The annual momentum trend is positive and that it is likely that the intermediate downtrend correction low of March of this year will hold," end of quote. I took a look at the March lows and the cash market, it was 1687. At about 2:30 this afternoon, the gold price was comfortably above that level at 1764. Michael pointed out that this recent decline of more than $200 per ounce came on the heels of the Fed chairman's recent Federal Reserve talking points. Then on Michael's weekend 360 degree report published this past weekend, he noted that while the quarterly momentum charts of the stock market are in distinct jeopardy of breaking their action to the downside from a momentum perspective, the two alternatives to equities, namely gold and treasuries, have shifted in the opposite direction. In other words, heading high from a momentum point of view. Michael pointed to a weekly closing number for gold of $1,864 during the next quarter as a secondary positive for a likely next move higher now that the downtrend momentum channel has been broken to the upside. While this 200-plus gold price decline has been painful for those of us with large gold positions, I see it as a marvelous buying opportunity for solid gold and silver mining companies and exciting exploration stocks like SK Mining, which is on to a gold and silver-rich VMS discovery that appears to be a carbon copy of one of the highest-grade mines in Canadian history, that being the great SK Creek Mine just north of where SK Mining is beginning its 2021 exploration season. There are many other companies as well that are sponsors of this show and many others that I cover in my newsletter that are certainly exciting stories, evolving exploration success stories that are making their investors a lot of money. And I certainly hope that some of you would consider subscribing to my letter because this is a very exciting time. And quite frankly, I think when we see declines like this, it's a good time to consider entering the gold share and exploration markets. We do have to go to a commercial break now, but don't go away because when we come back, Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me to talk exactly about SK Mining and the very exciting story that is unfolding there. They have now started their 2021 drill program, and so I expect over the next several months we're going to have a lot of exciting news coming from SK Mining. We do go to break now, but don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Quentin Henning.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Firefox Gold is actively exploring in Finland, where recent discoveries have sparked a new gold rush. Firefox controls a major portion of a prospective gold belt, giving the company a distinct advantage for exploration and strategic partnerships. The company's strong international leadership team, combined with its Finland-based exploration specialists, will put Firefox on the crest of the coming wave of gold discoveries. Firefox Gold trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol FFOX. Go to firefoxgold.com to subscribe for updates.
SK Mining Corp, trading under the symbol ESK on the TSX Venture and ESKYF on the OTCQB, is a mineral exploration company targeting precious metals, rich VMS deposits in the heart of British Columbia's Golden Triangle. SK Mining controls a prospective land package totaling 130,000 acres, which lies across a geologic trend that once hosted the prolific SK Creek Mine. With a world-renowned geological team, funding in place, and shareholders such as Eric Sprott, SK Mining is on the cusp of a world-class discovery. Go to skmining.com to subscribe for updates.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Dr. Quentin Henning with me once again. Today, he will give us an update on this year's exploration program for SK Mining. It's a very large-scale program, project, I should say, and very exciting news coming on the heels of last year's results. They are on to a precious metals-rich VMS project. Again, I'm very excited about it as a shareholder and as it's a company I cover in my newsletter as well. SK Mining trades in Canada under the symbol ESK. You buy it in the U.S., as I have, under ESKYF. My latest reading that I have is 162.2 million shares at $2.45 Canadian earlier today when I checked it. giving a market cap just a whisker under $400 million in Canadian money. Thanks for joining me again, Quentin.
Always a pleasure, Jay.
Always great to have you with us. With your success stories that you are building quite a portfolio of, I must say, and this is a company that you are an advisor, a technical advisor to. Last year was the maiden drill program for SK Mining on its massive 100% owned, I think it's something like 52,000 hectares. It's a very large holding for sure. And it's really, you came up with some very exciting results last year on this VMS project. Talk to us a little bit, for the sake of those that may not be familiar with the story, what did you discover last year and how does that set things up for this year?
Yeah, look, last year was, in spite of COVID, was very exciting. We generated some phenomenal drill results late in the year, or I should say we drilled the holes late in the year. We got the assays back. I think the first batch came back in December, and the second batch was earlier this year. But 18 of 20 holes hit significant gold mineralization. We'll call it, likely potentially economic mineralization. And they're very, very close to, say, the numbers that would be put out by Skeena, for example, which is drilling similar system to next door. All right, now, the two targets that we drilled last year, TB and Jeff, are a fair ways from Skeena. They're about 13 kilometers to the southeast, and they are within our 526 square kilometer, 100% controlled land package. to put it in context, what are these? Well, they're basically precious metal-rich VMS deposits. Okay, these are massive sulfide deposits, black smoker-type deposits that formed on the seafloor many eons ago and have been abducted, basically pushed up onto the craton, onto the continent. And, now we can explore these things. What was on the seafloor is now, sitting high in the mountain in British Columbia. But they are absolutely wonderful deposits, and they tend to occur in clusters. If you look at VMS around the world, almost all VMS deposits occur in districts or camps in which there's multiple deposits. They usually display a spectrum in size, from anywhere from a few hundred thousand tons up to, in some cases, 100 million tons or more of sulfide mineralization. Now, SK Creek, everybody, who's in mining, knows something about SK Creek. It was the highest grade gold deposit on planet Earth while in operation for about 15 years or so. It had a head grade, 42 grams per ton of gold, but it also had 2.1 kilograms of silver per ton. All right. And SK Creek kind of sits by itself. Everybody scratched their head and wondered, well, where on earth could the rest of, is there anything else out there? Was it just truly a one-off? Well, I think the discoveries that we're making on SK Mining's ground is now showing that this thing is likely going to, deliver multiple high-grade intercepts. So we're ecstatic. The Jeff results that we announced in February, we had a long interval. I think it was 30-odd meters of over 10 gram per ton gold equivalent in that one hole. And, what are we doing? We're going right back in and drilling in that TB Jeff area right now. Like the first target we have is to really be aggressive at extending out those systems.
Mm-hmm. And so can you talk about this year's drill program? How much drilling are you going to do? What's the cost? I guess you're getting started now. You're setting up your drill program now. If the drills haven't started to turn, they will shortly. Talk to us about the objectives of this year's program and what you hope to achieve there.
Certainly. Look, we're going to drill minimum 30,000 meters. We got four Diamond Core rigs. Two of those rigs are going to be dedicated to each of the TB and Jeff targets. The other two rigs will do systematic testing of numerous other targets. Okay, so we have it's not just about stepping out. Really, it's about making additional discovery. We did put out a news release yesterday that announced the start of drilling, so the program is underway. Full team is on site. We have been doing a geophysical survey as well. It's called SkyTEM. It's basically an electromagnetic survey that looks at property of rock in the ground, and in particular, it's looking for areas of conductive versus resistive rock. What we can see with that survey is the stratigraphy, and we know that there's certain host stratigraphy, you know, layers of rock. We'll call it that host is VMS mineralization. So we aim to use the SkyTEM data to give us a good handle on additional targets that we can drill this season. We have just an all-out program this year, a very robust drill program, 30,000-meter minimum. And I think by the end of this season, we'll see TV and Jeff probably grow dramatically in size, perhaps even connect, but then we'll also have likely have additional discoveries.
How close are the TV and Jeff discoveries?
They're a little over 2 kilometers apart. Mm-hmm. If they were to say connect, given their size, each respective size, I would say there's at least 3 kilometers of mineralized area in that. But it gets better. Like if you look at the SkyTEM to the north and to the south from TV Jeff, the system clearly continues. Mm-hmm. Like there's going to be likely be sulfide discovery, along at least a 7 kilometer corridor that we've done survey. Now, the new survey is going to extend that area further. Okay, so we're taking the survey clear back up to the SK mine area, and then we're taking it to the south as well, down into the area where we produced some just phenomenal stream sediment anomalies late last year. So we're going to see, we'll basically be able to see the whole enchilada here soon.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the company's presentation, and SK Creek, I think you said about 13 kilometers, if I remember what you said a moment ago, from the Jeff and the TV. But then there's the Sib and Lulu. And just looking at your presentation, there's some historic drill results there, I think, in that area. 14.4 grams of gold, 1,060 grams of silver over 14.3 meters, 10.8 grams of gold and 766 grams of silver, 24.8 meters, 2.13 grams of gold, 4 grams of silver over 25 meters. So, I mean, that's, I think, up in the Sib and Lulu areas, which is between the Jeff and TV and just south, but south of, I suppose, that maybe, 6-7 kilometers south of SK Creek?
That's right. In fact, that area that you're talking about, Sib Lulu, is on the, it's on the same strike, the same rock units that SK Creek is, on the west side of the SK anticline. So an anticline is simply a term for an upfolded sequence of rock. You know, think of a wrinkle in a carpet, a form of nice linear, up warp. Mm-hmm. And in this case, there's 2 sides to the up warp. Okay, so the west side, which hosts the SK Creek mine, but also that mineralization continues down to our Sib Lulu target. That is one side of the anticline. And yes, Skeena has drilled basically right down to our fence line. So we know that we have very good potential to bridge that gap, basically bridge Sib Lulu in with the rest of the Skeena system. But mm-hmm. then the TB Jeff Jay is on the east side of the anticline. So we are focusing a lot of our attention to the east side of the anticline, given these very robust results that we have. I think that the east side of the anticline is perhaps just as prospective, if not more prospective. Mm-hmm. And I think here soon we'll be able to talk more about that once all the SkyTEM data comes back.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And I'm just wondering, are you going to be poking some holes in the Sib Lulu though this year? Any chance?
We'll be. That's one of a long list of targets that we have. We are doing additional geophysics to really flesh that out. Like that SkyTEM we did last year did not fully cover the Sib Lulu area. So we're actually collecting that data right now to help us better target our drill program at that location. But it is one of many. I want to emphasize that. We have many, many targets that we're going to test this year.
Indeed you do. And I'm looking at page 24 of the presentation, and I'm seeing it's showing these district scale structural geology. It shows all these anticline structures, and it goes all the way to the southern end of the property where you have things like TET and C10 and CFJ and a whole host of different targets that you have in sight. So I guess, though, the main focus of most of the drilling will be up at Jeff and TV, though, in an attempt to to expand that. Is that right?
I would say, you know, T-Bay and Jeff, definitely important for us, but like I said, two rigs are going to be testing other targets. And the area that you mentioned there, the one in the south along the Eskay anticline at the extreme southern end of the property, that delivered some phenomenal stream sediment results last year. So that we know there's a really good, really strong gold, arsenic, antimony, mercury, et cetera, like classic Eskay type Blegg anomaly, what we call Blegg anomaly in that area. And it's big. I think there's at least 6 kilometers of strike that is the drainages are shedding very high levels of those elements. But like you said a minute ago, there's other anticlines. We actually see 3 anticlines that cross the property. They all trend more or less north-south. Mm-hmm. And the 3 anticlines, it's kind of like having, like I said earlier, like 3 wrinkles in the carpet, okay, side by side. So we have basically 3 corridors, and on each wrinkle, we've got an east and a west limb to explore. So one of the really intriguing areas that popped out last year in our stream sediment sampling was on the eastern anticline. We actually found a very high stream sediments anomaly at the north end of that anticline in a position, we'll say, that's, you know, mirrors what you see at the Eskay anticline further west. Okay, so we see just a screaming Blegg anomaly at the north end of the eastern anticline. That one really intrigues us, and that's part of the reason we decided to be aggressive with our SkyTEM program. Is we wanted to see if the signature, there's a clear, you know, target, geophysical target underneath that Blegg anomaly. And you know, I think that that's going to be very exciting once we get our SkyTEM out in the market. I think, you know, once we've collected it and processed the whole thing and be able to tell the story, I think people will very quickly see that this bigger picture is very concrete, I'll say, and will likely deliver multiple discoveries. I got to be, you know, somewhat cautious, but, you know, look, it's a matter of drilling. We have to drill these things, but I think we'll see a lot of really good targets, in short, that we're going to hit hard this year. And again, by the end of this year, we should have multiple discoveries across the board. Oh,
forward-looking statement for sure, but nonetheless, based on some early geological observations by yourself and your team there at the company. How many rigs then will be used? Will you have employed there this year? Yeah, you said.
Yeah, 4 rigs, 4 drills operating, and we can drill. Well, we've started drilling about 3 or 4 days ago. We will drill up through mid to late October, about 4 months basically. And again, if the drills perform, you know, like we hope, then we should get at least 7,500 meters per drill, but we might be able to get more. Like, you know, I could see potentially drilling 35,000 to 40,000 meters with a bit of luck, especially with weather. We need good luck with weather.
Yeah. How long can you go there generally? What do you expect normally?
Yeah, look, last year I think the last day of drilling was around October 16th or something. It really depends on the, you know, sometimes it can start early, sometimes late. It's been a very warm year up there this year. It seems like all of the West Coast has been just absolutely bizarrely warm.
Yeah.
You know, even at Eskay, I think it was warmer there yesterday than it was here in Denver. So.
Oh, well, that's in a way, that's good news, global warming notwithstanding. But just how much money is the company well-funded to finance this year's drill program?
Yes, it is. We raised money. We were aggressive late last year, and I wanted to see that happen because I wanted this drill program to happen. I didn't want to be last in the queue. I wanted to be first. So we raised about 13 or so million last November and added to the treasury we had. Brought us to 15. We still have, through some warrant exercises recently, I think we still have about $15 million in the bank. So we're well funded.
All right. Well, and turnaround time then, once you get the drilling, that's one of the issues with just a few seconds left, and maybe a quick comment on that.
Yeah, look, we don't know what to expect from labs this year. Obviously, there's a lot of companies with a lot of money, but I hope over the past 6 or 7 months that the labs has really, you know, started to ramp up in anticipation of this season's exploration. I don't know what to expect quite yet, but you know, we're going to do our best to make sure that we get a reasonably fast turnaround.
All right. Very good. We'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much, Quentin, for being with us again, explaining this very exciting program. We'll talk to you again soon about this one and some others that I know you are working on. So thanks again for being with us. Well, that is it for this segment, folks. But don't go away, because right after the commercial break, Ron Stoffel will be with us to discuss his annual In Gold We Trust report, and more specifically, the monetary climate change and gold, without a doubt, impact the lives of everyone listening to this show. We'll see what's going on. Ronald definitely thinks that we're heading into some significant inflationary times. So we'll wait and see what he has to say about that right after the break. So don't go away.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Lion One Metals is focused on high-grade gold in Fiji, led by legendary Canadian financier Walter Barikoff. Lion One is permitted for production and drilling for discoveries in one of the most exciting high-grade gold projects in the prolific South Pacific Ring of Fire. Lion One trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol LIO and on the OTCQX under the symbol LOMLF. Go to our website at liononemetals.com for more information about Lion One Metals and high-grade gold in Fiji.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Ronald Peter Stoffel. He is a chartered market technician and a certified financial technician. In 2006, he began writing reports on gold. His 6 benchmark reports, called In Gold We Trust, drew international coverage on CNBC, Bloomberg, and Wall Street Journal, The Economist, The Financial Times. And for all of us who follow gold markets and follow gold in the markets closely and realize the importance of gold as money, we do look forward to this annual In Gold We Trust report, which Richard co-authors with Mark Valick. So I'm really happy to welcome Ronald Peter Stoffel with me. Thank you for joining me again, Ronald.
Thanks for inviting me, Jay. Good to talk to you again.
It's really good to talk to you, and it's really good to see the attention that this annual report that you and your colleague Mark are putting together. First of all, I should tell our listeners that your annual report, In Gold We Trust, is available, I believe, online. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think people can just simply go to ingoldwetrust.report. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's available for free in English, in German, and also in Mandarin, in a big version that's 350 pages, but also in a compact version, which is, you know, 20 pages, just the highlights of the report.
Yes, and it's excellent. Both of them are excellent, I must say. You pointed out in the past that currencies are based on trust. What gives currencies trust? Why do people trust currencies? I mean, the dollar has been trusted now since 1971, when there seems to be no backing other than perhaps a geopolitical military backing with a petrodollar. Some people refer to the dollar as a petrodollar. But what gives a currency trust, and where, with respect to trust, where do you think the world's reserve currency now stands?
Well, we write in the report that trust comes from repeatedly fulfilling expectations. And I think that gold, really over the last centuries, has repeatedly fulfilled expectations in in good money and in sound money. So actually, I think, you know, this topic of trust was the leitmotif of the 2019 Ingoldby Trust Report. And the interesting thing about is that the trust is basically is essential for us, you know, in all different spheres of our life. When we go to a restaurant, we trust the chef, we trust the pilot when we jump on a plane, we trust in business, of course, our business partners and so on. But the interesting thing when it comes to trust, that it is highly asymmetrical. So you need decades to build up the trust, and then just within seconds, this trust can be lost. And I think that actually when I look at markets over the last couple of months, it seems that people are kind of losing confidence in paper money, and they want to allocate their capital in real assets. You know, we're seeing it in commodities, we're seeing it in real estate, we're seeing it in precious metals, obviously, in the art market, also in cryptocurrencies to some degree. And this is a bit like Ludwig von Mises described in his, when he wrote about the cracker boom in his fabulous book, Human Action.
So it's years of trust, but as you say, it can dissipate very rapidly. And yeah, maybe just get your take on Bitcoin now that you mentioned it, or cryptocurrencies in general. Where do you think they're going? Do you think they will play a part sometime in the future on a global? Well, I guess they already are playing a part, because a lot of very large monetary interests and hedge funds and the like are invested in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. But what are your thoughts about it? About cryptocurrencies as playing a major role in the future going forward in the monetary system?
Well, I have to say that there is it is an extremely emotional topic. Mm-hmm. Jay, we know that gold is a very emotional topic, but when it comes to Bitcoin, well, that's even more emotional, and many people think that they have to have an opinion on gold and on Bitcoin, even though sometimes it's not really a well educated and researched opinion. Mm-hmm. that they have. You know, when it comes to Bitcoin, I have to say that I started buying Bitcoins very early on. Not enough, as my wife keeps telling me. But I followed it because I think it's really from a from an intellectual point of view, it's really interesting, you know, the white paper by Satoshi Nakamoto came out basically as a reply to the great financial crisis, and I think that whoever invented Bitcoin, he clearly knew about the flaws of our monetary system. He understood the Austrian school of economics. He understood how gold works, and therefore, I think the biggest similarity between gold and Bitcoin is obviously the stock to flow ratio. So we like what's going on in this space. Of course, it's an extremely volatile ride. We've got two investment funds that combine traditional gold, physical gold stored in Liechtenstein, with digital gold in a cold storage. And we actually use this volatility. For us, it's not an enemy. It's actually a friend. So we are riding options in these highly volatile markets, which gives you enormous premiums. So I think that's a very prudent way to play it. Jay, to answer your question, will Bitcoin be around in 5 or 10 years? I don't know, but if it should be around, then it would probably be significantly higher. So why not have like a 1 or 2% portfolio allocation in Bitcoin and in the crypto space in general? I just can tell you that I'm meeting very, very smart, ambitious, and hardworking people, developer, entrepreneurs in this space. And I think, you know, lots of it, of course, it smells like a bubble. It feels like a bubble. There's lots of rubbish business models out there, but some will really change the way our system works, and especially, you know, in a decentralized finance space. I think for traditional banks, that's clearly a big competitor coming up. So at one point, I would say money is just technology, and therefore, if we regard Bitcoin as technology, then I think it has a significant upside. And I always compare it to, you know, you can go from point A to point B in a big, comfortable, safe SUV, but you can also, you know, get a really fast motorcycle. Of course, that's more volatile and it's much more riskier, but it can also be more fun. But why not have both? So our view is pretty much agnostic. I think that Bitcoin isn't the enemy of gold, and vice versa. I think it's really the fiat money system, and I think that you want to hedge against all those imbalances and bubbles that were created over the last couple of years, and I think that hard money is obviously the best hedge against it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an open mind then with regard to these cryptocurrencies, because nobody really knows the future like that. But I want to get to your title, the title of your this year's annual report in Gold We Trust, Monetary Climate Change. Exactly what do you mean by monetary climate change?
Well, of course, it's a bit of a, let's say, provocative title. But for us, it's just important because nowadays everybody is talking about climate change and sustainability and ESG and SRI. And, you know, I bought a six-pack of beers yesterday because we've got the Euro Cup coming up with now in Europe, and that's always a good excuse for having a couple of beers with your friends.
Sure.
And it says, yeah, this beer is climate neutral. So it's really in all areas of our life nowadays, we're seeing references to ESG, to SRI, and all those things. But from our point of view, you know, nobody is talking about the climate change that we are seeing in our monetary system. Nobody is talking about the non-sustainability of our monetary system, which is probably even more important than the other climate change. So what we describe in this year's report is the developments that we saw happening over the last couple of quarters, especially, you know, with the big tipping point being the COVID crisis. So the first point obviously is austerity is out. Nobody cares about fiscal conservatism anymore. The frugal Swabian housewife, I mean, that's what we had since the Greek crisis, especially favored by the Germans. This is over for now. I think fiscal policy is really, really taking over. But then we are seeing also, second point, the merging of monetary and fiscal policy. And if you follow the speeches by central bankers over the last couple of years, they always said, well, we've done our job. Now it's really fiscal policy that has to take over. And this is what's happening now. And then we're seeing quite a lot of new tasks for monetary policy. So if you listen to Madame Lagarde or Jay Powell, you know, sometimes I feel like they are working at Greenpeace or they're social workers, because it seems that they're really focusing on different topics nowadays. And I think I'm not criticizing it. I'm just observing it, but I don't know if really the mandates of our central banks were changed, and I don't think that the mandate of a central bank is to fight climate change or fight inequality. So this is clearly changed. And then we're seeing central bank digital currencies being introduced. Which is the complete opposite, basically, of decentralized cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. But this is another sign that this digitized fiat currency system will be probably one of the next steps of financial repression. And I think another important point is this new ice age between the East and the West. So those are five topics where we say that they're really crucial to understand. And why is it so important? I think if you have a look especially at fiscal policy and the consequences for inflation, it is obvious that fiscal policy has a more direct and a much faster impact on the economy and on the inflation compared to monetary policy like quantitative easing, where you basically try to stimulate the economy via the banking system. So those are the main points that we're describing. But yeah, as you've said, it's 350 pages. So that's only a very, very short summary of of all the topics in the report.
I think you've just answered the next question I was going to bring up. If I remember last year, you were probably more of a deflationist, or at least you had this view of the dangers of deflation. Clearly, it seems, and for reasons I think you've just explained, you're more concerned now about inflation. Consumer inflation, I think we've always had, you and I would probably agree that we've had massive amounts of inflation in asset prices and stock markets and real estate and so forth, but we haven't seen it at the consumer level. Now, if we have helicopter money that is being showered upon the populace, massive millions of people getting checks in the mail or checks in their bank account, it certainly would have that sort of Keynesian effect of demand, stimulating demand more than just the monetary policy. So I guess that's your answer. That's why you're more concerned now about inflation. It seems clear to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think we all know as a student of monetary history that our debt-based monetary system has to avoid deflation, whatever it takes. So it is an inflationary system. However, deflationary forces were quite strong, and they're still around. I mean, technology, of course, but also the debt levels, they're also a big deflationary factor. But I think now the inflationary factors are just stronger than the deflationary ones. Now, of course, the Fed keeps telling us, and I once said in an interview, I think they're listening to Guns N' Roses at the Federal Reserve, because they just keep telling us all we need is just a little patience. But you know, I think it's not transitory, and we shouldn't be too patient, because it is really a structural change that we are seeing when it comes to inflation and how inflation is created. A couple of thoughts on that. The biggest drivers probably are, well, velocity has collapsed over the last couple of months. Now with economies opening up again, I see velocity stabilizing, and it will start to rise, and will meet an enormous amount of liquidity that was created over the last couple of quarters. Then we're seeing that Asian countries are now starting to export inflation rather than deflation. From our point of view, now we're seeing a bounce in the US dollar, but structurally we see a weaker US dollar. Then we see demographics are slowly turning inflationary. That's a very, very interesting chapter in our report. We're seeing increasing geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and China and U.S. and Russia. So we could really be at the beginning of a second Cold War. We're seeing, and this is going to be a very, very important topic over the next couple of months, rising wages. In many, many industries, we are now seeing a real shortage of labor, especially for skilled labor. We're seeing rising minimum wages. We're seeing rising unit labor costs. So a return of wage inflation might really be on the horizon. And then lastly, I think we should not forget, I think people focus too much on the Federal Reserve. We should focus more on the White House. I think that big government is back, if we like it or not. So we should listen much more to politicians, what they've got in mind with fiscal policy. I think they like the job, that they like the fact that now everybody wants to see big government coming back and, you know, more stimulus, and we're getting used to it, and we know that there is a tremendous declining marginal utility of those programs. So we always need more and more, and it's like a sugar rush. So if you drink like two Red Bulls, of course you will see an effect, yeah, and you will see this effect quickly, but it fades off and you won't feel better afterwards. So I think those are the main inflationary drivers. And it's interesting because over the last couple of years, they always told us, well, we need more inflation. Now it is here. But now they keep telling us, no, it's only transitory.
Yeah, right.
The excuse to continue to be dovish. So, it's a pretty interesting constellation that we're now seeing, I would say.
Yeah, I have to ask you about the mining sector, this gold and silver mining sector, for example. Those industries, those mining companies have generally done well during deflationary times when their costs, when the price of their metal, of gold and silver, is rising faster than their costs. Now, what happens now, Ronald, if we're, you know, and I believe you're right, I think this is not transitory, that we are in a rising inflationary environment for the reasons you just talked about. But do you have a sense of what that might mean for the mining industry, for gold mining companies? My sense is that if costs are going up, you're probably going to be looking at higher grades potentially, and generally speaking, low energy costs, but labor costs are going up too. We're seeing that in various ways, various areas in the mining sector, I know. But I would just like to hear your comments on how you think a rising inflationary environment might impact the gold and silver mining space.
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, on the cost side, it would have an impact. You'll see it with fuel, obviously, which is, oil is one of the main drivers for on the cost side. We're seeing it with explosives, probably also with labor and so on. However, I mean, we crunched the numbers and analyzed what has the biggest inflation beta. So what works in an inflationary environment? And it starts with commodities, then gold, and then the mining space. So if you think that inflation is becoming a topic, then I think we should do very, very well with mining stocks. And you know, just for the sake of comparison, the total market cap of the companies in the HUI index, the Gold Bucks index, which includes the 20 largest unhedged precious metals producers, it's now at the moment it's 180 billion, which is equivalent to, I think, 0.5% of the total market cap of the S&P. Just the valuation of Apple is currently 10 times the total market cap of the HUI. So I think, you know, that the mining space had the most profitable year in history last year. We saw gold prices were rising and all-in sustaining cash costs were basically flat. This year should be at least as good as last year. And you know, I had like 120 company meetings last year. This year already had 50 meetings with company representatives. And I can tell you, those companies are doing a tremendous job at the moment. They are producing enormous amounts of free cash flow. They really care about their shareholders. They're doing share buybacks. They're increasing their dividends. We're seeing lots of positive developments in the junior space. So for me, really, it's terrific. I'm seeing lots of great opportunities, and sometimes I really feel like as a value investor in the mining space, and I think, you know, it's been a tough space to invest in over the last couple of decades, but now I think it's fantastic, and we don't need a a gold price at 2,500 for those companies to make really serious money. They are now, some of them are real cash flow machines at the moment, and still, I don't see really a lot of interest coming in from market generalists.
That's right. So do you think the mining companies, the big guys, have done a better job of controlling costs than they have in the past? I know in the past when you have a bull market in gold, a lot of times the big guys go out and overpay too much for the juniors that are discovering the gold or the silver or whatever the metal is. And do you think that they're maybe better managed now, the major companies, than they were at some times in the past?
Yeah, I think so. I think they are better managed. I think they also improve their communication. From what I sense, we are seeing institutional players like endowment funds, but also pension funds coming in. I don't really see the big retail money coming in, and I think that the big move by generalist investors, it hasn't really happened. Last year when Berkshire Hathaway announced that they were buying a stake in Barrick Gold, which was only a very short love affair, I think that created lots of interest from many investors. But I think, you know, we just should take this opportunity, and at some point I think markets will realize that there's lots of value in this space. Not only on an absolute basis, but especially on a relative basis. So, and then if you combine that with a good outlook for gold and silver, which we obviously have, then I think that's pretty much of a sweet spot that we're seeing.
Just a couple of minutes left yet, Ronald. I'd like to ask you to maybe a general comment on, you know, you point out that history rhymes. It's never exactly the same. What period of history are we currently rhyming with?
Well, that's a great question, Jay. Perhaps it's a bit like the 1960s and the 1970s, perhaps beginning of the 1970s. I mean, I wasn't alive back then, but from what I've read, perhaps it's a bit similar to, you know, 1963 to 1970. In the U.S., we had this guns versus butter debate. Guns were referring to the Vietnam War, and butter to Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society programs. And in the end, it wasn't guns or butter; it was guns and butter. and now it seems a bit similar. I mean, we're fighting wars against a health crisis, against climate change, and still against terrorism. And then, of course, there's you know, the big enemy from China approaching. But then, on the other hand, you know, I think there's all those government handouts, I think they will continue. So it is definitely guns and butter now as well. And we know what happened in the 1970s. So, you know, it won't turn out exactly the same way. But I think, and you know, taking a step back and not really focusing on the daily noise, you know, the debt piles were already pretty high before the COVID crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Now they are even higher, and they are significantly higher. So just in the U.S., the debt per capita, it rose 25% last year.
Yeah.
Just in 1 year, which means that the flip side of that is that a big move in interest rates is probably impossible. So if there should be rate hikes, I think it will be a very, very short campaign, because we simply cannot afford it anymore. So from my point of view, we will have to see negative real rates over the next couple of years. And that should really be the foundation for this bull market in gold. And, you know, Jay, if you would tell me, well, I see real rates at plus 3-5%, then yeah, I would say, well, then you have to sell all your gold.
Mm-hmm.
Just get rid of it. But I just don't see it. I really don't see it, and I've got no idea how that should happen. And that's basically the foundation for our positive stance on gold. now that inflation is really, really back, everybody says, well, it's not here. And, you know, it's only transitory and it will be, it's, yeah.
Well, you know, Ronald, I am old enough to have remembered. I was a very young man in the 1970s. In fact, I remember very well 1971, August 15th, reading in the New York Times that Mr. Nixon was temporarily removing gold from the monetary system. But I hear what you're saying, and I must agree. I think I see a lot of similarities with that. The whole idea that it was transitory, there's no reason to worry about inflation, and yet the Federal Reserve chairman of that time, Arthur Burns and G. William Miller, were pumping money into the system like there was no tomorrow. And, yeah, I think that's a good analogy. I know there are people that disagree with that, but I do want to thank you, Ronald. We're out of time. I think it's just excellent. People that really should read this, if they're serious investors, they need to understand the reason why gold is going up. And really, gold is going up because the currency is going down. I think you would probably agree with that. That we really, it's really a story of replacement of currency and a loss of confidence that you talked about, trust. We still, most people still trust the dollar for sure, and it's still the world's reserve currency. But as you say, that can change very, very rapidly. So,
and you can be married to your wife for 50 years, and we're celebrating, you know, 50 years of the end of Bretton Woods. But then you come home from work a little bit earlier, and you meet your wife with your neighbor in bed. So that trust is gone. it can happen quickly.
Well, I hope it doesn't happen to you or to me. But in any event, I get the message. It does happen. That's for sure. And we know that monetary systems go to the dustbin of history, as they say. So, Ronald, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us. And I really want to suggest to our listeners that they go to ingoldwetrust.report. And read this, either the abbreviated one or the longer one. It's very much worth investing the time to do so. So thank you very much, Ronald, for being with us again.
Thank you very much, Shay. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Next week, my guests will be Michael Pembroke. He's a former New South Wales Supreme Court judge and author of a new book titled America in Retreat, The Decline of U.S. Leadership. Another Australian, Michael Hudson of Hannon Resources, will join me to discuss that company's massive silver copper discovery in Peru. And Michael Oliver will be here as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
NV Gold Corporation, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in Nevada with an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2021, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors, a globally recognized technical team, report coverage from industry gold experts, and a strong treasury. Visit NVGoldCorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.